This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Hello, and welcome to Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers. I've got the giggles now. It's not even funny. Sorry, let's try that again.
Are you sure you wouldn't like a few minutes?
No, I'm fine.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. You're not helping. All right. Hello, and welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, Reading Like a Writer, how critical reading informs the writing process.
I'm surprised that
Madeleine just needs a moment.
I'm kind of a bit shocked and surprised that Roland Barthes hasn't managed to slither his way into the episode title.
I think he probably will do. In fact, there's no probably about it. He will slide in on his little snail trail at some point during this podcast. It's unavoidable.
It is unavoidable. He's here. He's among us. Some sort of horror story.
What gets me is that Alan and I were talking about something the other day. We were talking about a book, and I can't even remember what book it was. And then he started talking about Roland Barthes, and I'm like, where the hell did you pick this up? Because he doesn't really listen to the podcast, so I must have been talking about Roland Barthes at some point, and the fact that, you know, once something is out in the domain, it no longer belongs to the creator, etc., etc. And Alan was quoting it all back to me. It was quite disturbing.
Yeah, Sean, whenever I go, oh yeah, the Roland Barthes sliding on his slime trail, he's like, is that the death of the author guy? I'm like, yes!
Yeah, so there you go. He inveigles everything. He is the unwanted guest at every party.
He is. And we can't really talk about reading as a writer without talking about Roland Barthes, because this is the part that kills me every time. Roland Barthes may actually have a point when it comes to reading as a writer. He might also not have a point, but unfortunately, we do have to invite him to this particular party. So buckle up, kids! This is going to be a ride.
Wear your sou'wester and your gloshes. Okay, I'm going to start with a quote by Stephen King.
Okay.
This is from On Writing. If you don't have time to read, then you have neither the time nor the tools to write. Now, that's not going to be very popular with some people, because... Yep. What it implies, obviously, is that you must be reading constantly in order to inform your writing. And to a certain extent, Stephen King is right. But taken out of context like that, and as that quote so often appears in memes and various other places, for people who don't read, well, I suppose don't read like I read, then that's kind of a saying, you can't write if you don't read.
Yeah, which I personally take issue with as a dyslexic.
Now, what it's worth bearing in mind is that there's many forms of reading. Listening to an audiobook is reading. Listening to an informative literary podcast is reading. Taking in a blog on a particular subject and looking at whether the author's got a point and then perhaps going and finding out independent sources of verification is reading. All of that is reading. It's critical thinking more than reading that's important. The average person reads 12 books in a year. That's actually not very many. And what you have to remember is that number is inflated by a proportion of really avid readers out there, people who are even more avid than I am. So I've read 150 books this year.
That's 10 times the amount that I have, Jules.
But that's the thing. You know, I kind of need it like breathing, and reading is my chosen form of my chosen way to engage with new ideas and media, whether I'm reading non-fiction or whether I'm reading fiction. But some people will get as much from critically viewing a series on Netflix or watching the news and going, you know, this is rubbish, I'm going to check out the source of a verification behind the story, etc. So, yeah, I stand by my point that it's critical thinking that matters, not necessarily how much you read. It's how you read.
Yeah. It's about the consumption of media,
yeah,
and understanding why media is popular, what has made it popular, why it's engaged with you, the techniques that were used that made you engaged, and things along these lines. These are the best ways that you can learn to write. And the best ways, yeah, you can learn to write is by actually recognizing what works for you as a reader.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I agree Stephen King's got a point in the sense of if you've never read a book, if you don't enjoy reading for its own sake anyway, then
yeah,
why are you writing, quite frankly? Why are you choosing writing as a way of engaging? Because honestly, if you think it's a way to make a quick buck, then Madeline and I, and Roland Barthes as well, who's sat in the corner over there, are going to laugh you out of here. We really are. Because that's genuinely not how it works.
Definitely.
And, you know, why on earth would you want to create books if you don't enjoy reading them? It doesn't make any sense. So Stephen King is right in that sense. And
yeah,
I think that's more what he was getting at with that quote from On Writing than,
yeah,
okay, if you can only manage 5 books in a year, then you're not really a proper reader, therefore you can't write anything.
Yeah.
Now, talking from personal experience, reading a lot and reading very critically all the time constantly definitely informs my writing, and I think it's meant that I've gone up the learning curve faster than I would have done otherwise.
Hmm.
That's not better, and it's not worse, that's just, you know, faster. So
yeah,
let's not equate fast with good, because it isn't necessarily, and it's not necessarily bad, it just is what it is.
Yes.
Some people don't read as much as I do, or they read more than I do, and they would go up faster, or they wouldn't go up fast. You know, some people read so much that they don't have time to write, and
yeah,
that's right off the other end of the scale, isn't it? But yes, because my chosen form of engaging with media is reading, that has enhanced my critical thinking in that particular area, and then has been applied to everything else. So,
yes,
for example, the way I now read means that engaging with series on Netflix means I'm constantly analysing things like scripts and dialogue and whether that particular plot worked, whether it was, yeah, thought out.
The use of foreshadowing, the use of character introduction, things like that.
Yeah, absolutely. Obviously, that sort of thing shouldn't really be applied to the news, because hopefully it isn't fiction. Obviously, you can never tell these days. But yeah, certainly for drama or fictional media, to be honest, with video games as well. If you've got,
yeah,
a strong story-driven video game, then this is something you could be having ticking over in the back of your mind as you enjoy said video game.
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah. And it's basically all about the way in which we shape story and the way in which we tell story. And yeah, we come back then again to what Stephen King was saying. And really, for me, it's actually not so much about reading, but about engaging with stories, be they true stories, be they critical, be they fictional, non-fictional, it doesn't really matter. It's how we engage with a story. And part of reading as a writer, I mean, the definition of reading of a writer is onto itself its own debate. There are lots of ways that people can claim you read as a writer. One, for instance, some of the theories of how you read as a writer. Some people say that reading as a writer involves reading a text and then rereading it with a list of questions and analysing use of writerly techniques and how they were successful.
Yeah.
Other people say reading as a writer is actually not about that. It's about understanding the context behind the world. And I can get behind that because, okay, say for instance, reading as a writer is all about looking at the techniques that a writer used and not copying them, but basically learning from them. If that was really the case, then how would reading something like Chaucer help in modern day writing now? Now, regardless of what you think of Chaucer, I'm pretty sure if you wrote something like Chaucer and submitted it to most publishers, they probably wouldn't take it unless they were in particular looking for a parody or something in the likes of Chaucer, oddly enough. So what then can we learn from reading Chaucer which is valuable? Why then should we study Chaucer? Why then, well, can you engage with Chaucer as a writer? And I'd argue that yes, you can. You can engage with Chaucer as a writer by looking at the context of the period in which it was written, by looking at the reception it would have received, by looking at the way that it engaged with humanity.
Yeah, definitely.
So there's lots of different ways you can read as a writer, basically.
Yeah, Chaucer's a good example. So Shakespeare, not just because Shakespeare pretty much used every plot that was ever going and has Shakespeare been reimagined so many times.
Shakespeare did take quite a lot.
But okay, let's start with Chaucer. Chaucer was obviously a brilliant observer of human nature, excellent at deducing motive and probable outcome. Yes. That's what I tend to get from Chaucer. And yes, it was parody, it was satire, and you get the sense that he's taking a strong amount of salacious pleasure in parodying people he may have met, and I rather enjoy that.
Yeah.
If you find that the Middle English a barrier, then that's unfortunate, because it really is written to be read in the Middle English, because a lot of the jokes only really make sense in the Middle English, in the same way that a lot of Shakespearean jokes only make sense in Shakespearean English.
Yeah.
Moving on to Shakespeare. Shakespeare's a lot more character and plot driven, except when he is just dealing with theme in some of his later plays, like The Winter's Tale, for example.
Yeah.
But the interesting thing is we've mentioned this before with Shakespeare, he tells stories on multiple levels. And if that's a skill that's worth using as a writer, even if you're,
yeah,
like Alan, for example, says that Shakespeare was basically the EastEnders of its day. Yes and no. Obviously, I make this face that's something akin to a bulldog chewing a wasp whilst having toothache and still wincing at something that it's heard that was political satire that fell flat. That's the face I pull. Yeah, Shakespeare actually tells grand sweeping tales, and at the same time gives you a level whereby the lowest common denominator person trying to access that particular form of media could have done so. You have, yeah, to remember that, you know, that if you had the money to pay for it, you could go into the Globe.
Yeah.
So it was one of the few places where different classes wouldn't necessarily have been rubbing shoulders, but would have been able to enter and see this play at the same time.
Yeah, it did have to appeal to an incredibly large audience of a very different variety of classes and sexes and people. Yeah, so.
And yet still contain big ideas, things that were flattering to certain potential benefactors or benefactresses. And
yeah,
yet at the same time still manages to be true to what the author thought, or seems to have thought, based on themes that continually reappear in the plays.
The interesting thing about Shakespeare is that he did seem to be having kind of moral dilemmas a lot, yeah, of the time, and especially in some of his later works as well. And I mean, we know that his writing changed, particularly after the death of his son, Hamlet.
Yeah.
Which had an incredible effect on him. So we know that his writing changed, but he also, this is a man who had to write for a patron, and he had to write to appease certain class. So a lot of what he wrote was propaganda, but was probably also at the same time poking fun at certain rules and regulations and certain things like that. We look, for instance, at The Merchant of Venice.
Yeah.
And his portrayal of a Jewish character.
Yeah, I mean, that's really interesting, because at a time when Jews were not met with much sympathy, you can read that play as Shylock is an oppressed person who has turned vicious. And
yes,
understandably turned vicious under the sort of racism and,
yeah,
ridicule he's encountered.
I think the thing to remember is that Jewish people were banned from coming into England. I mean, they're definitely would have been some Jewish persons living in England at the time, but no one actually knew what Jewish people were like.
No, and that, you know, right up until the sort of Victorian era, there were rumours that, I say rumour, there was this vicious background rumour that Jews ate Gentile children. That's the blood rite that they performed during their Sabbath.
Yes.
And so murders and things quite often got blamed on local Jews. You know, times of hardship, famine, they blamed the Jews. You blamed the outcasts, and they were made the outcasts.
Yeah. And it's no coincidence, of course, that a lot of the imagery that we associate with witches also was negative imagery that was associated with Jewish people. So the eating of babies, long noses, warts, things along those lines.
Red hair. Believe it or not.
Even curls as well, actually.
Yeah.
These are all things. These very offensive and very incorrect stereotypes were actually the only real access that the English audience had to the Jewish people. They'd never, no one would knowingly would know they'd met, knowingly would know. No one would know that they'd met a Jew if they had, because, as I said, it was illegal. It was definitely not something that you would be advertising if you were a Jewish person hiding out in England at the time. So no one would have had any personal interaction with any Jewish person. So the only knowledge they would have of them would be these very, very negative stereotypes. Now, Shylock is still not an incredibly likable character. And people say that Shakespeare really did the bare minimum. But considering, again, the fact that this was an era in which no one had any kind of context of what Jewish people were, other than being the equivalent, really, of witches and being murderers and being all these kinds of things, which was genuinely believed, to then have a character who has such an incredible speech of, you know, if you prick me, do I not bleed?
Yeah.
To humanize a character which had otherwise been totally removed from humanity. And if you read Shakespeare now, without the context, it seemed that the play was being very anti-Semitic. And within the context of the current day, it is very anti-Semitic. But when you have within the context of what was happening during that period, you get an idea and a theme that perhaps Shakespeare was actually making a point in the only way that he possibly could, that we were not, the Jewish people who were so hounded, who were so discriminated against, were actually not these monsters that were being portrayed, but were just other human beings.
Yeah, how would you act under the same treatment? And it's very noticeable in a lot of his plays that Shakespeare generally champions the underdog, whether that's a Jew, a woman, just somebody who, bastards get championed a lot by Shakespeare as well, even when they're doing unconscionable things. And I suppose one of the things, this is something that's worth remembering when you're reading, just when you're reading full stop, but when you, particularly when you're reading critically as a writer, is that when you read something that was written way back in the mists of history, you need to remember to read it within the context of the time as much as possible. So, for example, you have Aphra Behn, the female playwright, who mm-hmm. wrote a novel about a black slave resisting his masters. And now people poke at it and say, well, you know, this is the noble savage trope. And yes, yes, it is. But it was making a damn good point at the time, you know, when slavery was legal and everybody considered black people to be no better than animals.
Yeah.
So, again, you have to read it within the context of the time. I mean, you don't have to like things like Gone with the Wind, because let's face it, that book contains a lot of racism. It's not there gratuitously. It's part of the backdrop of the historical context of that novel. And yeah. It's awful. But on the other hand, if you take that out of that book, then the book ceases to make sense in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
I don't want to see racism portrayed in books in the future. And certainly when it's not a case of, oh, well, we know it's wrong now. Well, yes, I'm sure we knew it was wrong back then. But you need to take the tone of the times a little bit when you're reading critically. And it's okay to say, well, this is awful. I wouldn't be able to read Huckleberry Finn aloud now, considering how often Jim is called what he's called in that.
Yeah.
But at the same time, removing those sort of references means that you lose something of the understanding of the time it was written in.
Yeah. I think another thing to remember is that during the time that Shakespeare was writing in, if he'd been overly sympathetic to Jewish people or to these minorities within his work, it wouldn't have just been a case of he would never work again. He could have literally been killed for it.
Yes, I mean we've mentioned before with Jane Austen and how she wrote a lot of things in code.
Yes.
As well, for the same thing, you could be imprisoned for saying something that looked like it was detrimental to government or church.
Yeah. So I think it's, if we compare maybe how someone sort of in the modern day says, oh, you know, I was writing that because it's actually meant to be I wrote something offensive, but it's not actually offensive. Look, Shakespeare did. It's not really comparable because, yes, you can actually be torn a new one for saying the wrong thing nowadays. But it's really, really non-comparable. But there's much less of an excuse now, at least in Western society, to be not just sympathetic, but to be, you know, to use correct terminology, to be understanding and not to fall back on terrible archetypes. I mean, homophobia, it just, you can't really justify it in the same way in a text than to say Shakespeare would have been able to justify homophobia in his work.
Yeah, the thing was, that particular example, it wasn't illegal back then. It didn't necessarily make you an outcast either. It was undesirable in the royal family. But yeah.
But I just mean an example. And I think, you know, the other thing, they're not comparable times. And the way in which we handle sensitive matter now it can be very different. We can be a lot more expressive and a lot more, not offensive, but in the modern day now, we can challenge the government, we can challenge religion, we can challenge homophobia and sexism, things like that in our media and our art a lot more easily than they could have back then.
Yeah, generally, depending on obviously where you're writing in the world, but
depending where you are writing in the world. If you are, you know, in the Middle East, then yeah, you can get in all sorts of trouble for writing anything that's even vaguely wrong. In the Western world, however, so I think that's another thing, an important thing to remember when you are analysing the way in which sensitive issues are handled back then and the way in which sensitive issues are handled now. And that's an interesting exercise to do if you're looking for reading as a writer exercises. It's an interesting thing to take an old text and see how they handle the sensitive issue in comparison to a modern text and how they handled the sensitive issue.
Yeah,
and
definitely.
Actually, is it correct for the time period? Was it handled sensitively enough in the modern day?
As a side, yeah, sorry, brief sidebar, and then I want to go on to something else, but brief sidebar, talking about reading critically, perhaps not you, Madeline, but you in general, listeners, you're hopefully listening critically and engaging with us in that way right now, but perhaps you're the sort of person who would like to see more LGBTQAIP+ characters in fiction, and I salute you if that's the case. I'm with you there. But what you stumbled across is something that doesn't show that the character is explicitly gay or trans or whatever, but sort of mentions it in passing in the text and still bills itself as trans or gay fiction. And it is. It is because it does have that character, but it's not providing what you want. I've seen on Twitter recently a lot of authors who are basically forced to come out publicly in order to justify writing a particular character's viewpoint. And perhaps part of their writing process is them coming to terms with something about themselves. Perhaps it's just, you know, they're a bit timid to start with because maybe they're not part of the LGBT community, but they're trying to come to an understanding of it because they want to understand. I think a lot of us would do well to remember that we don't have the right to demand. We can request, but we should perhaps not demand. And yes, read critically. If it's clearly used as a case of, well, this is my unique selling point to get through the door, and actually I have no interest in these issues whatsoever, then that does deserve some criticism.
Yeah.
But what I'm coming across a lot of lately is bisexual female characters in young adult science fiction and fantasy, and the female character happens to end up with a male partner. That doesn't make her less than bisexual, by the way. And I am getting a little bit sick of seeing these flaming criticisms of the author who has clearly made this character bisexual and had them have female partners in the past, but they just happen to end up with a male in this particular instance.
Yeah. I can see why some people would be upset with that, because they'd say, you know, I can understand. But at the same time, I also agree with you, Jules, because we can ask, but demanding is a different thing. And this comes from a very personal perspective, in that people have complained about Rufus and the fact that he's not explicitly bisexual enough in book one.
I thought he was.
The Sons of Thestian. Some people just didn't find that he was. They just didn't. They said, you know, the book is said to be LGBT, but we don't really get it. And, you know, I point out that actually that's mostly because romance is not really a plot.
Yeah.
There isn't really that much in the first book. And the romance that's there between Yonatan and Faye is actually kind of meant to be a bit sort of cautionary. That was me kind of saying, look what happens when you that perfect love doesn't exist. I was being very acerbic at the time. I was young. And of course, you know, when I first wrote The Sons of Thestian, I was just coming to terms with my sexuality myself in an environment surrounded by people where I didn't feel safe really discussing it. So having Rufus be a bisexual character was a real act of revolution for me. And it was, in the first draft particularly, very, very, very hidden, because I didn't feel safe enough having this openly bisexual character without that raising questions, without people then knowing and suspecting. But it also gave me a sense of power to know that he was bisexual and to have people liking him. Because I sort of felt like I tricked people into consuming gay media, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And so that was a very powering experience for me. And when I came to sort of rewriting it during a period of time when I was a little bit more sure of my sexuality and kind of understood it a lot more, and was in a little bit more comfortable position, I did make it a little bit more explicit. But I actually maintained a little bit of that element of putting it to the side at the time, because it was important to me. It was important to me during, and it marked a period of my life of great uncertainty. And I found it upsetting that people then said it didn't count. It didn't count because he wasn't explicitly being bisexual. And I don't know how you can be explicitly bisexual in a book without maybe just really overly sexualizing. This is the story of Rufus Melby, lost his fiance and is incredibly upset. But you see him flirting with a guy, and there's even mention of the fact that he goes and has a one-night stand with somebody else.
Well, it's like, how could he be? I don't see how he could have been much more bisexual, because surely the people who are criticizing this are the people who are going, you're not bisexual unless you're like ready for it from anyone at any time, and it's that's not what it's about.
Yeah, exactly. So I also think that whilst we should be demanding the industry for more representation, and when I say demanding the industry, I really do mean that there are lots of writers out there who are coming up with fantastic, very diverse fiction and are not being represented. It's not really up to us demanding any particular author, I don't think. Though I think we can ask, we can say, look, would you mind maybe reflecting more? We'd like to see ourselves in this particular world, such as Harry Potter or something like that. I think the best thing we can do if we want that kind of media is to demand it of the industry, to demand to see our voices met by writers who are already writing that. Because I think trying to force people to write things can end quite disastrously.
I think I think I didn't ask me anything on Tumblr after I Belong to the Earth had been published a second time, and somebody anonymously asked me whether M was actually bisexual, to which I had to say no, she's not. She's just not. I'm afraid she's not that, and I'm not going to like retrospectively claim that a character is it's gay or bisexual without having put the you know having have without having foreshadowed it in the first place. But I did think it was a good point in the sense of if that reader, and here we get to Roland Barthes, if that reader wanted to read her as bisexual, they could do, and they absolutely can do right up to book three, where she does say, I actually kind of don't like girls like that. And this isn't a case of me saying, well, I'm not writing a bisexual character because I don't believe in it, because obviously that's bollocks, and if you read the rest of the books, you'll see that that's, I clearly think that's bollocks. But it's just this one character has very definitely said, no, I just don't really swing in that direction, and that's okay too. But yeah, it was out of my hands, and if a reader wanted to read her like that, I thought that's really interesting. And I did actually sit and think, well, could she be? And it's like, no, she just genuinely, the character's talking to you, and she's kind of saying, no, this isn't me, kind of thing.
And it's like how in book one of The Lives of the Gentleman Bastard Sequence, The Lives of Locke Lamora, I read Locke as a trans man. I know, having read the rest of the series, that it's very, very, very unlikely that that's how he was written. But, and I hate to agree with you, Roland Barthes. He's looking far too happy with himself. But I have a right to read that because every time we read a book, we're already only going to be reading that book based on our experiences. And I'm part of the LGBT community. This is something which is very close and precious to me. And it's something that I see. And so my reading of that is entirely valid, and no one can take it away from me. You can say, well, that's not what the author intended, but it doesn't actually, according to Roland Barthes, matter what the author intended in that particular case, because me, the way that I've read it, that is the story that I've read, and my reading of it is entirely valid.
Yeah, absolutely. It doesn't take anything from you at all anyway to have someone, I mean, there's something wrong if someone says to you, I read your character as gay or whatever, and you get really, really upset about it, because it's like, why would that upset you to that extent? What bothers you so much about it? Unless you've categorically said, no, they're straighter than a ruler kind of thing.
And even then, if you've written a character who's constantly saying, I'm straight, I'm totally straight, I'm really straight, I'm more likely to read them as gay, to be honest, because that just sounds like a
Me
lot
too. So it's like, well, it's like, if they really are straight, why do they need to keep saying it? It's like, if they're really a strong female character, why do you have to keep putting strong in front of the words female character? It doesn't make any sense. So, actually, reading critically, pay attention to people who have little tells like that. Sarah J. Maas, when she's like, well, I was High Lady of the Night Court. It's like, well, perhaps you're actually not Feyre, because you're saying it a lot. And methinks the lady doth protest too much in this instance.
Jules, for God's sake, leave Sarah
I'm
J.
not over
Maas
it
out of
yet. I'm not over it yet. Never. I'm trying to remember what I read recently where I was clearly re it's I know what it was. I read Tempest and Slaughter by Tamora Pierce. And it wasn't a great, it was okay, but it really felt like just a prologue to what was going to be an actual part of the story. And it takes one of the characters from one of my favourite series, The Immortals, Noumea, who is a mage, one of the only black robes to have been born in a century. And he's lovely. He's the most adorable little cinnamon roll imaginable. As in really, really big, tall bloke and immensely powerful. And yet he's interested in people and their lives. And he's interested in animals and nature. And he's not really interested in big exercises of power. And I think the only reason I kind of got on with the book as well as I did was I realised halfway through that I was reading the enemy from the later series of books I've mentioned, who was best friends with Noumea when he was at university. I was reading this enemy as being secretly in love with him all the way through the book.
Yeah.
And it really, to me, there's nothing obvious there, except that Azorn never ever has any lovers. And, you know, they're getting on to 16, 17, and Tamora Pierce never shies away from her teenagers going off and having sex and experimenting and stuff. And, you know, he speaks very scathingly about his mother looking for possible brides for him because he's a prince, and the fact that he's kind of like, oh, what would I do without you, Noumea? And there's manly hugging going on, and I'm like, I'm so reading it that Zorn's in love with Noumea. I know Noumea's straight, but I'm really reading it that Zorn might actually be gay, or maybe ace and just sort of like gay romantic kind of thing.
I can get behind that. I do that for a fair amount of stuff as well, actually. And yeah, there's nothing wrong with it. It's actually, as we say, it's part of down to the experiences that we've had and the way that we choose to read things. And actually, it can really inform our writing as well. We can't really talk about sort of reading as a writer without, you know, talking about adaptation.
Yeah.
As well. And adaptation obviously requires reading as a writer, because you are reading something and then you are writing it anew. And how you then read it can really inform the creative ways in which you adapt something. For instance, let's go back to Shakespeare again, just because he's on my mind because of Upstart Crow. Let's think of Othello. I always read in Othello that part of Iago's jealousy comes from the fact that he's actually in love with Othello.
He
doesn't really want to admit it, that there is a homosexual element of there's repressed homosexuality. If I'm adapting Othello, adaptations, there are lots of ways you can adapt something. But some of the best adaptations we've had have been ones which have challenged or changed the way in which we understand things. For instance, Sherlock Holmes, it's been adapted several times very recently into the modern BBC version. We have Elementary, and we have the Robert Downey Jr. Sherlock Holmes. Each of these adaptations have taken parts of the original and put something new to it. So for Elementary, for Sherlock, it's set in the modern day. Elementary takes it a step further and says it's set in the modern day. We've removed it from London and we've put it in America, and we've changed Watson to a woman. And then you have the Robert Downey Jr. version, where it's kind of become, rather than a sort of a mystery film, it's become this thriller action sort of genre instead. And through the genre change, you get these other things as well. And there is a kind of, there is this sort of romance between Watson and Sherlock as well in that, which they don't really shy away from at all. But these are all based on the fact that the source material was read differently, and Guy Ritchie, who made the he was the one who did the Robert Downey Jr. Sherlock Holmes films. You know, he talks about the fact that when he was listening to the audio tapes of Sherlock Holmes, he never imagined him as this kind of he did see him as an action figure.
Yeah.
And so there we have an interpretation of reading as a writer, as someone who has read this character as an action figure rather than this kind of
Quite.
totty snoot. Not totty snoot, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, definitely. And obviously he's betrayed as a kind of an opium addict and someone a bit unreliable. His brilliance kind of is a bit of a burden to him as well.
Exactly. And that means that we have this new adaptation of Sherlock as an action series instead. And it's a very successful adaptation. So there we have an idea of how Roland Barthes was correct, because I don't know whether actually Arthur Conan Doyle was imagining Sherlock Holmes as an action figure. Somehow I doubt it. You're certainly envisioning him as a, you know, but Sherlock Holmes was definitely more of a gentleman, a bit
Yeah,
robotic, a
he
little
even,
bit inhuman, but.
yeah, he reads quite mild in a lot of ways and a bit distasteful of violence as belonging to the lower orders of man, as it were,
Yeah.
depending on which story you're reading, because obviously his character shifts a little bit as you go on through. But it wasn't written like we write serial fiction now, where there's an overarching character journey.
No. So in this case, yeah, we see that Roland Barthes is right, and actually, by killing the author and their intention and allowing ourselves to see our interpretation as the truth, we can then progress in our own writing and come up with new and original content. I think the important thing when it comes to killing the author and accepting the truth of our own reading is that we still remember that it is our own reading and that everyone else's reading is just as valid. Of course, you are allowed to discuss and argue and say, well, that's not how I read it, but you can't really hold the moral high ground unless you're not going to go with the death of the author trope and say, well, yeah, you say that it's this, but we know for a fact that the author intended it to be this.
Yeah.
And then someone could easily turn around and say, well, I don't care what the author intended. This is how I'm reading it, and you can't change my mind.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately you can't mess with someone else's headcanon, and where a lot of the conflicts come from are when people try to impose their headcanon on other people. And
Yeah.
the thing is, you're all entitled to your own headcanon, and no one can do anything about that. That's fine. You can read a character however you want. But
Yeah.
you cannot expect everybody else to embrace your own headcanon, I think is the
No,
problem.
you can't.
Okay, right. Bad writing. Bad writing can actually tell you a lot about your own writing. Not because your own writing's bad, but it can show you what you. I have a point, and I'm going to make it. It can show you what you don't like, and then you can analyse why you don't like something, why it doesn't work for you. And I think I've probably learned more in some ways from reading what I consider bad writing or bad plotting or whatever than I have from reading something I really love. Because sometimes if I really love it, I can't actually take it apart enough to find out why I really love it. But with something bad, I always can.
Yes, I've certainly noticed that.
I'm not going to slag anyone off here. I
I've
will
already
tell.
dragged Sarah J. Maas through the mud, so you know.
She dragged herself through the mud. I just
Oh,
pointed out she was
shut
down there.
up!
Ultimately, all you need to do really to be a writer is to be able to tell a good story. You know, it doesn't have to appeal to everyone, it just has to appeal to a certain target audience, or it has to appeal to you if you don't want anyone else to read it.
Yeah.
Story ultimately is king in order to write a book, largely. There are people who write more literary fiction where story is not king at all, but I'm not a literary writer, so I'm not going to touch that one. But I'm going to tell you.
Leave them with the indie kids.
I am going
Sorry,
to.
sorry.
Yeah.
Sorry, that was a reference to the. I realised that I wasn't actually talking about that this episode, but yeah, the whole The Rest of Us Just Live Here by Patrick Ness. Yeah, leave literary fiction with the indie kids. It's its own barrel of fish.
Okay. So the thing is, you can really enjoy something at the time, and you might reread it several times, and then you'll have a little bit of a gap. You'll read other things, you'll expand in your ability as a writer and as a critical thinker, and you'll think, I know what I fancy. I fancy a break from all this critical thinking. I'm going to go back to something I really loved. And you'll try to read it, and you'll think, this isn't actually that good. I can write better than this now. And it's a bit of a blow to find that it can't pull you in enough for you to turn off that inner analyst. And I'm talking from personal experience here, because I've spoken before about how the fact I just really enjoyed the Twilight books, even though I knew that perhaps they weren't very, very good in a lot of ways. Mm. And I just thought, I fancy a break. I'm going to read a bit of Twilight. And I'm like two chapters in and I'm thinking, this is really clunky, overblown prose. And I'm trying really hard to turn it off, but it's actually kind of getting in the way with me engaging with the story.
Mm.
So it's not that it's bad, it's just a case of I've come to expect a higher quality of prose. And possibly I'm trying to read something for a break that I'm not actually in the mood for. Like perhaps I should have gone back to Harry Potter or his Dark Materials or something like that. But
yeah.
Because you can be very much, if you want a break, you should mood read, really. You shouldn't force yourself to read something that you're not quite in the right frame of mind for. But I was surprised that I'm noticing things now, idiosyncrasies in the text that would never have registered with me before, because I was just enjoying the story for what it was.
Mm. Yeah.
Writing that has made me go, oh God, that's really bad, i.e. E.L. James. To be honest, that really made me think about plot and the fact that there wasn't one.
You and plot.
I know, it's my new obsession. I have done beta reads for a few people recently and I nearly always bring up structure, and it really is my bugbear now, apparently. It's structure, structure and plot. I don't necessarily think I'm wrong, obviously, but people don't have to agree with me. And I have become... Whereas I sort of pantsed I Belong to the Earth completely in like 3.5 weeks, now I really plot very, very tightly. I wouldn't say I was a massive, massive planner, but I have got an outline before I start a book.
Yeah.
So you can change. You can change how you go about writing. And a lot of that is to do with reading critically and thinking, this works. This has clearly been planned in advance. And or even this writer's clearly pants this and ought to have gone back and imposed a bit more structure afterwards, but hasn't done.
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah.
And I've even been thinking that about Stephen King recently, as in, I've really enjoyed it. I read all the Bill Hodges trilogy, which is supposed to be hard-boiled crime, and Stephen King's got this knack with narrative for me whereby I'll just read it. I love the characterisation. I love his turn of phrase. I really enjoy it. But I can no longer remain blind to the bits he doesn't quite get right. And it's always a 50-50 as to whether he will land the ending, because he doesn't plan in advance. He just writes the book.
Yeah.
And in a couple of cases there, I thought, you didn't really land the ending there. You stumbled on the dismount.
So, yeah, it's an example. It's, as you say, reading things that we don't enjoy can actually tell us more about our own writing than reading things that we do enjoy.
Yeah. I understand, obviously, if people have got limited reading time or they really only have like 5 books in them a year to read, well, that's fine. Then wanting to pick books they enjoy, that's fine.
Yeah, but I think it's just that if you ever get to, you read something and you didn't enjoy it, it's never been a waste of time. I think that's the important thing. You should never feel like, well, I've wasted my time, because you haven't actually. Reading bad things will help you ultimately, if only to increase your self-confidence.
Yeah, here's something.
Unless of course the bad thing you've been reading is your own is your own fiction.
See, I normally come to the other conclusion whereby I think that my writing is going to pop behind my back. As in, if I stop a book and I finish it, or even after it's published, I'm like, okay, the entropy thing's happening. The entire story's falling apart because I haven't got my eyes on it. And then I'll read back a little bit of it at some point and think, wow, this isn't unconscionable crap. This is actually reasonably okay. It's always a pleasant surprise to discover that. It's totally okay to DNF a book, to do not finish it. Yeah. And that's fine. It's even fine if you're given ARC copies or galley copies of something. Usually it's best to speak to the publisher and say, I couldn't finish it for X, Y, and Z, or to do a DNF review or whatever. But don't feel bad if you're DNFing a book. It's something I absolutely have this thing where even if I'm not enjoying a TV series or a book, I will try and push through it to the end, because I hate not finishing things. I am a chronic finisher. And I probably would be a bit happier if I DNF'd a few more things, but you know, that's just me. It's totally okay to do it, unless it's one of my books, in which case you absolutely have to finish it. I'm kidding.
Are you, Jules?
I'm totally kidding, obviously. See, look, Roland Barthes is nodding.
You've got a knife to his throat.
Madeline, stop giving away the secrets.
He's crying. Jules, he's crying, slime.
Oh, come on. No one makes Roland Barthes cry.
True.
Although if he read E.L. James,
he's a wicked little psychopath. Little wicked little psychopath running around murdering people left, right and centre. Yes.
Okay, a final thought. Read outside your genre.
Yes. Now, I've heard mixed things about this, because on the one side, reading within your genre is excellent because it allows you to know what's been done before, what's popular, what's selling, what's and also the kinds of things that people expect. And a reason that we sometimes read within genres is that there's a comfort in there, and that even if it's in a totally unique story, there are going to be certain things which we can come back to, which we expect and which we know. So if you've worked within that genre, understanding what people want from that genre is very, very important.
Yes.
However, it's also like a massive pool of water. And if nothing changes, it will stagnate. Reading outside of your genre can actually allow you to accumulate new ideas and new perspectives and new way of thinking things. For instance, a book like Six of Crows is a mixture between fantasy and also crime thriller, basically.
Yeah, it's a heist.
It's a heist, isn't it?
Yeah, it's kind of a gang heist type thing as well.
Yeah, and then if we look at TV, something like Firefly is a mixture between sci-fi and Western.
Yeah.
And these are both very successful versions of genres which have been merged together, or of, they're both, one's, you know, sci-fi and Western, and then the other one is definitely put within the fantasy section. But this is an example of drawing on other genres and other tropes and other things like that to bring a new light and side to a genre which is already established.
Yeah, definitely. And the other thing is, obviously, it gives you a bit of distance and perspective from your own genre.
Yeah.
Because you can get locked in to the point where you're like, I haven't included this trope, or I've included too much of this trope, and you literally cannot see the wood for the trees. Whereas if you go and read something completely different, it gives you a bit of perspective.
Yeah. Monty Python style.
Yes.
Sorry, you said it's completely different, and I can never hear that phrase without thinking, and now, something completely different.
Okay, I think that's pretty much all we've got time for this week. So it's time for our Dissecting Dragons recommendation, and Madeline has one for us.
I do, and I have mentioned it, that is The Rest of Us Just Live Here, by Patrick Ness. Really, really enjoying it. Very peculiar, different sort of parody. It's humorous. I do really recommend it. I think it's actually my first Patrick Ness book. I've heard him discussed a lot. Sorry, that sounds like he's disgusting. I've heard him being discussed by a lot of people, and I know quite a few fans of his. But this is the first time I'm actually reading any of his work, and I am actually really enjoying it. So that's my recommendation for the week, Patrick Ness's The Rest of Us Just Live Here. And on that note, guys, we'll say thanks very much for listening, and we'll catch you guys next week.
Thanks and goodbye.
Bye!
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders, or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note, no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.